welcome to this very special episode of My Shit Therapist and Other Mental Health Stories with me, Michelle Thomas. The paperback version of my book with the same title, My Shit Therapist and Other Mental Health Stories, is out on Monday, the 8th of March. So you can have my words in your eyes for less. Do give it a whirl. You'll like it, I promise. The paperback is available now at all good local bookshops and at all bad, terrible multinational corporations. So as well as the paperback, on Monday, the 8th of March, I will be publishing an epilogue in the ebook explaining what happened when today's guest, Laura, got in touch with me to communicate very gently and very lovingly how I'd got something wrong in the book. I made a mistake, and Laura very graciously gave me the opportunity to, first of all, sincerely and genuinely apologise for the very legitimate hurt that I'd caused to her, and to learn and make amends. And I'm very, very thankful to her for that. You'll hear more about that in our talk. Now, this episode comes with a class one trigger warning. We're going to be discussing in graphic detail Laura's experience with suicidal thoughts and homicidal thoughts that were directed at her husband and her baby. If you have any reservations about listening, please feel free to just tap out now and join us another time, okay? As bleak and as painful as Laura's experience is, her resilience and the love that radiates from her towards her husband and now almost teenage daughter is an absolute joy and privilege to witness, having heard what she had to fight through to get to where she is today. I hope you love it. I'd love to hear your thoughts. You can tag me on Twitter at myshittherapist, or you can email myshittherapist@gmail.com. Let's get into it. You got in touch with me after something that I'd written in the book was triggering for you. So in the section of the book, I'm describing how a therapist, nurse assessment person is asking me these questions about my condition. And she asks me, have I thought about hurting myself? No. Have I thought about hurting someone close to me? And I say no, and I write about how that makes me feel really awful because that's the worst thing that I can think of. And what I didn't consider at the time is how insensitive that is to people who do have these awful intrusive thoughts that do manifest themselves in thoughts of harming the people that they love the most. And when you sent me an email, just explaining that to me, and you were so generous and so kind and so gracious about it, and you would have been so within your right to just go on social media and go, this prick doesn't know what she's talking about, and she's just been really insensitive about something that's really, really harmful. But actually, by emailing me, and I emailed you back straight away and said, I'm really sorry, I'm just going to take a few days to process it because I want to make sure that I get the next steps right. And then we had a really enriching conversation for both of us, I hope. Thank you so much. That's just not something that I would have learned if you hadn't gotten in touch with me. So I really appreciate that. Would you mind telling us a little bit about your experience of postpartum depression? So first of all, up to that point, you hadn't had any kind of mental poor health at all, had you? Is that right?
Not to my knowledge. However, in hindsight, and when obviously I've had therapy and things now, things do come out. So I think there is a feeling from a previous therapist as well that it's something that I was probably susceptible to. I mean, I did, by no manner of means did I have a bad childhood or anything like that. You know, we all have our issues, and people, you know, people react differently to different situations. I didn't have the best father in the world, divorced my mum when I was only seven. And then I learned stories about him as I got older. And so I think I learned very early on to bury things.
Mm.
My mother will tell you this now, I'm still not the best at talking about how I'm feeling. And because when you talk about it, it makes it real. So if you don't talk about it, then well, you know, what's the problem? So yeah, I've always been very good at burying these things, not talking about it, not dealing with it. But unfortunately, you know, the situation with the postpartum depression, I just got to a point where that just wasn't feasible anymore. So I tried. I didn't go for help until my daughter was 3 and a half. But I, from the day I had her, I felt it. I'd had a bad pregnancy. I'd had preeclampsia. I can't remember the name of it now. So the last 6 weeks of just literally thinking I was going to die. I know it sounds very melodramatic, but I was so poorly. The day that I was due to go into the hospital, I'd got all dressed up. So my mum and I were going to go for lunch. Well, we're going to go to the hospital, get a jag in my bum, which is a great way to start off a Saturday afternoon. And then we're going to go for a nice lunch. So I had my prettiest maternity top on. It was fuchsia pink, matching lipstick, matching jewellery, maternity trousers. And I remember going into the hospital and all the midwives going, oh, you know, don't you look lovely? And what are you doing today? And all the rest of it. And anyway, they did a few tests while I was in there, and the midwife said to me, how did you feel? And I could feel my mother's eyes boring into the side of my head, as in, don't you dare say you're fine. Stock answer, I'm fine, thanks, how are you? And I turned around and said to her, I genuinely feel like I've been hit by a bus. I don't know how to describe, I don't know how to explain, I just feel ill. So they ran some more tests and basically said, OK, you're not leaving here without the baby. When I had the little one, who was as healthy as a little racehorse, she's 5 pounds of scrawniness, but and they put her on me. And I'd never actually held a baby before. I was 28 when I had her. So I wasn't, young. But I'd just never been around. I was the first of my friends to have a baby. So, my brother hadn't had any kids at this point. So I knew that I wasn't going to be, I wasn't a naturally maternal person, but I didn't expect this detachment, I think is the only way to describe it. And it wasn't I disliked her. There was just nothing. It was just flat. And you hear everybody say, oh, you'll never feel love like the first time you meet your child, and, it'll overwhelm you and it'll do this and it'll do that. And that was the start of the reasons why I didn't feel I could tell anyone. And I felt a complete sense of responsibility. I knew that I had to do everything I had to do to protect her. That she needed fed and she needed her nappy changed and she needed bathed, and I'd talk to her and I'd do what I can, but that I didn't love her, for want of a saying. It's so harsh and so hard to say now, but that the emotion just wasn't there. I was in hospital for about a week after I had her. One day it was actually my doctor, my gynecologist, came in, and because she was jaundiced, she was supposed to be over beside the window, but he came in and I was sitting at a chair at the window, and I literally couldn't have placed myself any further away from her. She was asleep in her, in the bedside kind of cot, and I think he must have clocked at that point, there's something not right here. So I just thought, I just need to get out of here, I need to get better, I need to get home, and then I'll start feeling it. So got home a week later. Walked in to the flat where we lived at the time, put the car seat on the coffee table with the baby in it, obviously. My husband and I sat on the sofa and just looked at this car seat on the coffee table and went,
holy crap, what do we do now? And I'm like, okay, that's not helpful. So my husband went back to work, and then it's me and still this little stranger who sleeps and eats and poops, and that's all you're going to get from a newborn. I'm sure everybody knows that. I didn't leave the flat for 6 weeks. You know, people would try and arrange things, and I would cancel at the last minute all the time. Then, you know, it's the sleep deprivation. So I'm up in the middle of the night. I think I told you the story before of being up with her at kind of 4 in the morning, as you do. And she was still very, very tiny at the time. So clearly had wind or fell in a nappy or something, because they don't smile naturally at that age. That's that horrible way where their mouth smiles, but the eyes do nothing. And she was doing that, and I just had this is my first memory of an unwelcome thought that, the first time I can remember thinking something nasty. But anyway, so I remember I looked at her, and then she had this smirk, for want of a better expression, and the thought that came into my head was, she tried to kill me, and she knows it. And that's why she's got this little smirk on her face. And I managed to push it out as quickly as I could after it came in. But you can't unthink it.
Anyway, the thought happened. There was nothing I could do. Didn't tell anybody, clearly, because they would have thought you're mental and we're taking your baby away. So that was my biggest fear, as much as I didn't have this overwhelming maternal connection with her. I wanted her. She was mine, and I knew that. So I certainly didn't want anybody, you know, taking her away from me. So anyway, I pushed that thought out and didn't say anything. And then the thoughts kind of gradually became suicidal. Simple things at the beginning, you know, you'd be, you know, doing the dishes and washing the sharp knives, looking at the knife and thinking, oh God, how easy would that be just to take that across my wrist? You know, I could do it right here, right now. Or I could continue washing the dishes and put the knives away, which is what I did. But the thought had happened, or be in the car and, you know, driving on, you know, a country road, or obviously I'm in Scotland, so it's a bit hilly. So everywhere you go, you're literally on the verge of a hill. And I could think, I could just turn the wheel. I could just turn the wheel to the left. I'm not going to hurt anybody else. You know, I'll just go down this hill. The car will roll. And they're thinking, why are you thinking that? You know, you drive this road every day. You've driven this road every day for years. And all of a sudden you're thinking about driving off it. So again, just didn't tell anybody, just tried to push them out and fight against them. So that continued, and then I would have, you know, lying in bed at night, can't sleep, and thoughts of, you know, my suicidal thoughts were never ever involved physically hurting anybody else. So it was always throw myself off a bridge or cutting my wrists or, you know, driving my car off a ditch. I would never, you know, jumped in front of a train or any of that. Those kind of things didn't come to me. So it was always right, okay, how can I do this that it's just me? So because I would never want to involve anybody else. And I don't even know how many nights I must have lain awake in my head going, you know, which bridge is better? You know, the Fourth Road Bridge or the Erskine Bridge? Or should we do, you know, it was so detailed in my head. And it's amazing that a thought can be so flitting, but have so much detail and impact in it. And when I say it out loud, the thought didn't last as long as it takes me to explain it, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, because it's images and that come into your head. It's so, so fast. But the detail in some of it was mind-blowing. And I suppose that made me feel that, well, if you've gone to all this trouble of coming up with this plan or this idea, you must genuinely feel like that is an option. And you feel like it's you that's creating the thoughts. You know, it's not just something coming into your head. And anyway, so this continued, obviously, for 3.5 years. Latterly, after about 2 years, it was a bit like my mind, whatever it is, I got a bit fed up. It's like, you know, she's clearly not going to harness, and she's not going to drive her car off a road, and she's not going to jump off a bridge. So what about if we hurt the baby? Now, that was the game changer for sure. I mean, you can blame yourself and you can take responsibility for suicide to an extent. And I, as much as it was awful to live with and it obviously made me so depressed, that having the thought of hurting someone else, just it was sickening. And I couldn't believe that I had thought that, but I had. And it then, you know, my time scales get a bit muddled, but it kind of manifested from, well, I could hurt the, you know, to it's really difficult for me to say, sorry, but
right, so take your time.
You know, to actually kill her, were the thoughts, and that then turned into, well, you can't do that, not because it's a bad or a wrong thing to do, but because your husband won't let you. And again, flitting thought that came in, and so then my brain decided, or my mind or whatever, well, that's okay, because what we'll need to do is we'll need to kill him first. And if we kill him first, it can't stop you killing the baby and then killing yourself. And then this will all be over. You know, you're not going to have to feel like this. And also, you're not leaving anybody behind. You know, you're not going to commit suicide and leave a little one without a mum, or, you know, my partner without me. It'll all be done. It'll all be over. And that was the absolute turning point. And I specifically remember, and it was, again, it was lying in bed when that particular thought of, well, you know, he won't let you do it. And I'm lying next to him, obviously, in bed. He won't let you do it, so you kill him first. And I'm looking, literally sitting, lying next to him, thinking, I can't believe that's just come into my head. He's lying there innocently asleep. And I am working out the best way to end everybody. Mm. And one night after, not long after that particular night, with those thoughts, I broke down and was sitting on the sofa with my husband and said, I can't do this anymore. This is how I feel. But I only told him that I was depressed and I'd had suicidal thoughts. Told him this, and he was brilliant. He phoned the doctor. He made an appointment. He came with me. He talked because I couldn't. So he, you know, essentially told the doctor everything I had told him the night before. While I just sat as a bubbling wreck, and I was very, very fortunate that I had at that time a really, really good GP who took this situation very seriously. So anyway, so she right away prescribed me sertraline, 50 milligrams at that point of sertraline, and put me on the waiting list essentially for counselling. So I started on my medication and it was horrific. Good Lord. I remember thinking, I actually said to my mum at the time, I don't know how people get addicted to this stuff because I feel rotten. You know, it was absolute roller coaster, you know, physically sick, total loss of appetite. I had no interest in food or anything. I just wanted to sleep. I just felt, ugh. But then, you know, maybe 2-3 weeks in, I started thinking, right, okay, this is, you know, I started having more good days than bad days, essentially. And it did seem to calm me, so it kind of stopped the boiling pot kind of situations. I never got to that point while I was early on it, but I was still having suicidal thoughts, etc., and still feeling low. And so I was about six weeks. We did talk about the suicidal thoughts, and the biggest thing that I gained from my sessions was this understanding that those thoughts weren't me. That's not who I am. These thoughts were, you know, whether you believe it's the devil on your shoulder or what, chemically imbalanced, whatever your way of thinking about it is, but it's not me. It's not Laura. You know, that I didn't sit down and create this scenario. It just appeared. And the importance of it's obviously it's not what you think, it's what you do with it. And I chose not to, you know, cut my wrists or drive off a cliff or, you know, whatever else. Now, by this point, I'd still never told anybody about the homicidal thoughts, not a sausage. So, you know, my husband still didn't know, my mum still didn't know. And in the session, I did say to the psychiatrist that I'd had these homicidal thoughts towards both my daughter and my husband, and I was expecting some sort of, you know, phoning 999 right away and carting me off. And she didn't even blink. And it was, okay, talk me through them. You know, what did you think? So again, this came into my head. And then I thought, so basically what I've said to yourself, you know, just ran through the scenarios with her. And again, it was the exact same advice. So to me, you know, the suicidal thoughts and the homicidal thoughts were pillars apart. You know, it's one thing, feeling suicidal, it's quite another. You know, having homicidal thoughts. But she treated them the exact same way. And again, it was you can't control what comes into your head. You can only control what you do. So think, you know, how strong are you that you didn't do that? You didn't let them, you know, control you, and you didn't let them influence you. But you cannot stop them coming into your head. Mm. And I, from that day on, I swear, I actually only realised I'd stopped having them when I deliberately thought about them, if that makes sense. So I thought, you know, previously I'd have one every single day. Every day there'd be a moment I'd go, oh, you know, drive the car, do that, whatever. And then I go, that's been a couple of days, I haven't thought that. And then I go, damn it, you know, I've just thought it. But it's almost like just rearranged my brain to go, you don't have to have these anymore because you're in control of them. So what's the point in having them? You know, because you're not going to do it. So, you know, it's kind of two fingers up to to my brain.
That's so powerful, Laura.
So that was incredible. Just to have that lifted and removed from day-to-day life, you know, to get through a whole day and not think something so horrible that it makes, you know, it turns your stomach, it makes you feel sick, and the guilt, you know, with the suicide as well as the homicide, the guilt that comes with that of, you know, what that would do to your mum, what it would do to your, you know, your loved ones if you were to do that. That's an awful thing to think. And so the talking therapy, in terms of the thoughts, really, really realigned my behaviour. So the medication, which I've been told I'll be on for the rest of my life, I'm fine with that. You know, it's I take the contraceptive pill every day. I take my medication every day. You know, it's a straightforward process. And I have stupidly attempted to try and reduce it, or I'm really, really bad at remembering my toddler my repeat prescription, to the extent that my husband actually hides some of my medication because he knows I'll run out, and then he'll go, right, here's a week's worth, I'm going to go and get your prescription.
That's lovely.
Bless him. So there have been times before he started doing that, and this is the reason he does do it, the side effects, the withdrawal, for want of a better expression, if I don't have it for, it used to be a couple of days, it's now, if I forgot to take it in the morning, by kind of 3 o'clock in the afternoon, I'm having, you know, electric shocks through my system, you know, you get little black spots in your eyes, and so my dependency on it has definitely increased. But, you know, it's, the person that I was before it, obviously post childbirth, but before the medication, I'd rather be medicated, Laura. I don't really get any highs anymore, but I don't get the deep lows either, so I can live with that.
Laura moved on to discuss how her experience helped her support her daughter through her own crisis at the age of just 9. Again, this is not an easy listen. There are references here to suicidal thoughts. Please listen with caution.
It must be 2 years ago. So she was only 9, and she was having these breakdowns, for want of a better expression, which I recognise. I was very familiar with the concept. So she was just come home from, you know, she good as gold at school, good as gold at the childminder. She'd come home and she'd melt down. But then she also developed this issue with eating. Now, not in a eating disorder way, but she was just really paranoid about expiry dates. I mean, she wouldn't eat anything that was kind of within 2 days was a no-go. We'd you'd give her something to eat, say a yogurt, for example, which maybe take the lid off and just give her the yogurt with the spoon, so the expiry date was gone. You'd hear, you know, be sitting in the living room, we'd hear her walking through to the kitchen, you'd hear the fridge opening, you'd hear the packet getting brought down, because she'd be checking the date before she'd eat it. Maybe it's an intolerance. So, you know, maybe dairy. So we started with dairy, so we'll just work our way through the food groups. Now the kind of meltdowns continued. The language that she was using was becoming more and more self-deprecating. So it would be, I'm stupid, I'm ugly, I can't do anything right. It was this kind of thing. Now, that's certainly not how we treat her as parents. So again, I'm thinking, well, is this something that's come from school, or no idea? And this one particular occasion, she was upset, and we were sitting next to each other, and I was just quietly just trying to calm her down. And she said, she was very, you know, very upset and hysterical in terms of her breathing and things. And I thought she'd said to me, "Mummy, can you calm me?" And I said, "Of course I can, darling. Of course I'll calm you." And she said, "No, Mummy, I asked you to kill me because I know I can't do it myself. So can you do it for me?" And I still don't know how I actually functioned quite level-headedly. And I said, "Well, no." I said, "The reason is that I'm your mum. I said, I have one job. I said, and that's to keep you alive and to keep you safe. I said, so I'm very sorry, but I'm not going to do that." And she then, you know, reiterated, "But I can't do it by myself." And I said, "Well," I said, how were you going to do it?" And my husband, when I told him this afterwards, he was horrified. he said, why would you ask a 9-year-old that? And I said, because if she'd had an answer, then I know she's actually thought about it. If she said, well, I'm going to cut my wrists or I'm going to whatever, then there's a possibility she's Googled this or, you know, she's researched this and she has a plan. But what she actually said was, well, I don't know, I don't know. So I thought, well, it's more likely that this has been a flippant statement, as kind of belittles it, but, you know, she says it without a real solid, I'm going to commit suicide.
Mm-hmm.
So we calmed her down after this point, and that was very much the point where I went, right, okay, this can't continue. We're not qualified to deal with this. We need help. And we then got given an appointment for 4 months' time for group sessions. And I thought, this isn't right for her. And it's group sessions with parents. And I just knew that wasn't what she needed. So we are, you know, we're in a fortunate position where we could afford to go private. Got an appointment with a private psychologist who specialised in young people. Needless to say, my daughter didn't speak at the first session. It was just, you know, sitting fidgeting with her jacket that was on her lap and, you know, nodding or shaking her head or looking at me. She'd really, really gone into herself. So we explained the full thing to the counsellor, and we talked about this issue with food and saying, you know, we're really struggling with her eating. However, I don't feel it's an eating disorder, but she has this complete paranoia about expiry dates and foods. And I was sat next to her on the sofa, and my husband was in a separate chair. And I just heard this ripping noise. And I turned to look at her, and she was sat with a handful of her own hair. And we all just looked at the same time, and I had a bin beside me, and I just automatically took the hair out of her hand and put it in the bin. And I said, what did you do that for? And she said, I don't know. And I looked at the counsellor. I said, this is new. I said, she's never done this before. One of the first things that the counsellor diagnosed her with, and I can't remember the fancy name for it, but it's basically a phobia of being sick, and specifically in her case, a phobia of being sick in public. So actually the treatment that she got, which was EMDR treatment, which sounds very dramatic because it's used to treat postnatal depression, be quiet Laura, post-traumatic stress disorder. But actually, this is the treatment that was used for her. But she dealt with all these emotions, with these particular situations, and she also gave her some calming techniques, which we still use now. And did come in handy. The way that she described it was, my daughter has a bit like a tank of fuel, and my daughter only operates between half full and full. If her emotions get below that half full, she can't cope, and she'll get upset, and she'll have these kind of breakdowns. There is no shame in admitting your child needs help. I mean, you can't, a mother and a father are not enough to raise a human being, in my opinion. You know, everybody needs external help. Now, I couldn't help her personally with her issues because I didn't know how. You know, I'm not by no means qualified. Yes, I could identify them and see issues, but I knew I needed a third party to intervene. And I'm so proud of her for obviously the way that she's managed it, but at the same time I'm really proud of myself. We need this generation to be the generation that grow up accepting mental well-being as being as important as physical well-being.
Thank you so much for listening. You can get in touch at myshittherapist@gmail.com. And if you need advice about postnatal mental health, you can visit the Panda Foundation. That's pandas, like the bear, pandasfoundation.org.uk. Until next time, take care and take your meds. Bye-bye.